Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
I'm Michelle Magwood, and it's a real pleasure today to be talking to John Stewart. He's the biographer of Sir Herbert Baker. Welcome
to Johannesburg. Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm glad to hear you're having your sightseeing around a lot of Baker buildings.
I'm just going from Baker House to Baker House in between interviews. It's absolutely fantastic.
Baker is routinely described as the leading architect of the British Empire, but never before has there been such a detailed and revealing study of his life. I learned so much about from your book. It's a really excellent one. John, you're a illustrious architect in your own right. What led you to Herbert Baker?
I kind of discovered Baker's work bit by bit because his reputation in the UK isn't as strong either as it should be or as it is in South Africa. And it was really only when I started to visit the buildings and thought, these are outstanding. You know, why don't I know about this work? You know, why haven't I been taught about Sir Herbert Baker and so on? And so I felt in a way that for such an outstanding architect to not be celebrated as he should was really quite unjust. And so I was keen to right that wrong, if you like, as much as anything else. And the more I get into his work and understood how he had developed as an architect, and then the extraordinary range of what he built right across the empire, the more fascinated I became, really.
You had an extraordinary source of information, didn't you, on the family letters?
I did. I mean, I started my research at the usual places, British Library, RIB Library, and then I emailed his eldest grandson, Michael, and asked if he had any family archive. And he said, well, I've got one or two things. Come down to the house in Bristol and have a look. And he took me to this Baker room, which had the shelves around the wall just lined with files. And he said, well, where would you like to start? I've got this. These seven files are contain his letters from Cape Town back to his brother. And this set of files are to his wife when he was in India. And the ones over here are to his mother when he was on his European tour that Rose had paid for. So it was completely overwhelming initially, the absolute volume of data. But I started working my way through it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fascinating, and eventually managed to bring some order to the whole thing.
And to read his notoriously difficult handwriting.
Yes, it was quite a challenge. And in fact, if Michael hadn't been in an adjoining room for quite a while, acting as my interpreter, I might not have made much progress.
Why do you think Baker is largely ignored now? Maybe that's too strong a word. Or has been sort of forgotten?
I think there's a few things. I mean, I think that period in British architecture wasn't of much interest to modernists or modern architectural education. So he's one of a group in that context. But also I think he's had quite a bad press in a number of ways. I mean, he rebuilt the Bank of England, but to rebuild it on the existing site, he had to demolish most of his predecessor's work. And Nicholas Pevsner, for example, the architectural historian, described the loss of the previous bank buildings as the greatest architectural crime in the history of London in the 20th century. So, you know, getting that hung around your neck, particularly from the most prominent architectural critic in Britain, was tough to come back from.
And Baker, I mean, he didn't want to do that demolition, did he?
He didn't. It's really interesting, actually, because he saved as much of the existing buildings as he possibly could. I mean, he should be remembered for what he saved rather than what was lost. His initial idea was to save the whole of the external encircling wall and as many of the existing bank halls as they could. And he presented that to the client, and they said, no, you know, we want a new building. Can you go back to the drawing board? And he came back again with further arguments, and he actually had to persuade the bank to retain, you know, what they did in the end retain. So he was a very early conservationist as well as an outstanding designer.
It must have been terrible for him. How did he come to be in South Africa in the first place?
Well, he didn't come here to start an architectural practice. He came to establish a fruit farm because the family's business was farming, but the British agriculture in the late 19th century was in a real long-term depression. So the family sold almost all their land and agreed to proceed with Baker's younger brother Lionel's idea, which was to buy a fruit farm in South Africa. So Herbert, as the older brother, just came along to make sure that the family funds were invested appropriately. And as he toured around, he saw the Cape Dutch architecture and fell in love with the countryside and the existing architecture. And then, astonishingly, 3 weeks after he set foot on the continent, he was having dinner and found himself sitting directly opposite Cecil Rhodes. And he was, Baker saw as one of the great individuals within the British Empire. Baker was completely starstruck, couldn't utter a word. And it was only because Rhodes found out later who this young man was that they ended up working together.
So it was absolute happenstance, really.
It was incredible.
I wonder what would have happened if he'd, if they hadn't met.
Well, he'd already started his own small practice in Kent and he was struggling for work. So his life was completely and utterly transformed by coming to the Cape.
Let's talk about his architecture now, if we can. We've always appreciated here how he kind of has carved his houses out of the rock, of the ridge, which I think is a very art and craft thing to do. To us, it seems like there's an honesty about Baker's houses, here on the ridge. How do you define this architecture? How do you read it?
Well, I think the initial work in the Cape was predominantly Cape Dutch, and that was a style he developed and really mastered before he came to Johannesburg. Then after he was invited to come here, he had the opportunity of building for the landlords, and he reverted to what was more the style that he'd been involved in England before coming over to Africa, and that was the arts and crafts. And so what we have are really a series, from my perspective, of arts and crafts houses dotted along the ridge in Johannesburg. So in a way, he came back to his roots with those buildings. And then, of course, as he moved on to the public buildings, started moving into classical architecture. Mm.
I was reading recently about the Italian architect, I hope I pronounce this correctly, Marcello Piacentini. He was Mussolini's favoured architect and built so many of those fascist buildings, but he survived fascism's fall, as a lot of his fellow architects, they didn't survive it. And they say it's because his buildings were rooted in the past, and he hadn't discarded history like his fashionable contemporaries had done. And it struck me that that's kind of the same about Baker, isn't it? A lot of his public buildings, his big things, are rooted in the past, aren't they?
No, absolutely.
But kind of they say that a radical doesn't last.
No, absolutely. And certainly as he moved into his classical work, I mean, first of all with Pretoria Railway Station and then in almost no time at all, the Union Buildings, he was pursuing what had then started to become established as the architecture of the British Empire. I mean, it got the title Edwardian Baroque, but the architects were really looking back to the early Renaissance architecture in England, Inigo Jones, Christopher Wren, and they saw it as symptomatic of the British spirit. So it was disciplined, it was restrained, unlike the Baroque or Rococo of these continental competitors who'd failed to achieve this vast empire that the British had. And so it was very closely related to the British psyche. And Baker's classical work really fell into that context and was very much an expression of the empire, wherever he built.
He really believed in the empire, that it was, it was a civilizing thing.
He did, yeah, and he was not unusual in that. You know, any educated young Briton of that period believed absolutely that the empire was a positive force for good in the world, that the more of the globe that was painted red, the better for everyone that came under British rule. And similarly with religion, that's why all the missionaries arrived in Africa. It was to bring them the benefit of Christianity. So that belief was if completely misguided, absolute. And the other fascinating thing for me as I tried to get my head around these views was the fact that they genuinely believed that the empire would last forever. So they would just take over more and more of the globe and the empire would go on forever and ever.
Perfect civilization.
Absolutely.
I was very interested to read about his work with war graves, which is a I'd say, a very particular kind of architecture.
Yeah.
You know, this it's a somber task.
Mm-hmm.
And to bring that kind of seriousness to what, tell me about his war work. Wargraves' work.
Well, I knew he was involved as one of the three architects who were selected by the Imperial Wargraves Commission to carry out the building of the cemeteries and monuments to those that had fallen in the First World War. But I didn't realise he actually started working on it during the war and visited France and Belgium in 1916 for the first time. So they were starting to look into the problem of how to deal with the scale of the loss and the graves. At that time, as people were still falling in the trenches, but the three architects developed an approach between them that they use consistently for all of the cemeteries. In addition to that, Baker was asked to provide a number of the memorials to the missing, because half of those who were killed in Flanders had no marked grave. So Baker was actually responsible for 110 cemeteries, as well as the South African Memorial at Delville Wood, the Indian Memorial at Neuve Chapelle, and the huge cemetery at Tynecott, which has it's the largest of them all with 11,000 graves. And Baker's approach was, although there was a standard approach generally to the design of the cemeteries, Baker's approach was slightly different. Some of the other architects veered towards a degree of triumphalism in that Britain had won. Baker rejected that completely. He'd wanted a place of peace and sanctuary that the relatives could appreciate when they visited their lost ones' graves.
Thank goodness that won the day, because those works are absolutely moving. They really are. The picture that emerges of Sir Herbert is of a quiet, reserved man, a highly cultured man.
Mm.
How would you describe him?
I'd agree. Although, he's a very interesting character, because he was quiet. We'd call him an introvert these days. I don't think they had the term back in 1892 when he arrived here. But very well read, genuine love for literature and poetry. I mean, it's said he carried a small copy of Wordsworth with him wherever he went. And yet he was the captain of the school cricket team. He was the captain of the school football team. He was very fit. He rode or ran almost every morning. It was just part of his approach to life. And he also had these extraordinary friendships, you know, vast number of friendships with highly influential members of the empire, really. Some of whom were clients, but most of whom were just friends. So, yeah, fascinating man. And, it's interesting because Rhodes was fascinated with him, for example, when they met. And that was what really led to them having a relationship that was genuinely friendship rather than just, as it started, architect and client.
Can you take us through the famous fractious relationship with Edwin Lutyens, his contemporary and once friend?
Yes.
It tends to overshadow also a lot of what Baker did. Tell us about that.
It does run all the way through the book. They met when they were both working for Ernest George in London, one of the leading architects in Britain at the time. Baker was the senior assistant, and Lutyens was a young 17-year-old who just joined the office. Lutyens was constantly making jokes and doing funny sketches and cartoons. Baker was absolutely serious about his work. Lutyens was very poorly educated, just educated by his family. His father was a painter, a very poor background. So completely contrasting individuals, and yet they formed this friendship. They were soon going on sketching tours, and then when Baker came to South Africa, they continued their correspondence, and actually Lutyens was invited out to design the Johannesburg Art Gallery and spent some time here in the city. And then when the opportunity of New Delhi arose, they seemed the ideal partnership. Baker had the experience. He'd already built the Union Buildings. Lutyens knew everyone in London, so he was going to get the job. So the two were selected, and they both worked on the development of New Delhi together. But they differed in terms of how they thought they should design the main government buildings, with Baker thinking all the government buildings should be on the raised hill within Delhi, Lutyens thinking, no, only my viceroy's house should be on the hill. And that really set the seeds of what became a dispute that rumbled on through the whole of their time working together. And Lutyens was constantly trying to get the design revised, even to the point when it was under construction. And Baker thought he was just being ridiculous.
He even went up to the King and Queen, took it up to the King and Queen, didn't he?
He appealed to the King and showed him potential revisions to the drawings. And I mean, much of which was being built by then, and to try and get the King on side, but that failed as well. And he finally realised that it was not going to happen. And at that point, he ceased any talk with Baker. So they were working together in the same office in Delhi. They had lunch together at either end of a refectory table, surrounded by the resistants who were told not to talk to each other. The family sometimes, in the later days in Delhi, came out to visit with Baker and Lutyens, and the children were instructed not to speak to Baker's children on the boat. It was utterly ridiculous.
Went on for years.
It did.
But right at the end of their lives, they did come together, didn't they?
They did. Lutyens then went on to try everything he could to damage Baker's reputation. And as I mentioned, he was very well connected in London, so that really did hit home. Despite that, towards the end of their lives, Baker felt, you know, we can't finish like this. And he wrote to Lutyens. And there was a rapprochement, and they started to lunch together and go to the Royal Institute of British Architects together and so on. So that was entirely down to Baker. He just wanted to tie up that end before died.
He was the grown-up.
He was indeed, yeah. I think that puts it very well, actually.
John, I'm interested in how architects then, they not only designed the buildings, but they laid out the gardens often. They laid out the gardens. They designed the furniture. And I think I would have liked to hear, maybe there's another book here, hear more about in the book about Baker dealing with his clients. I mean, he was a wrangler of very uppity ladies on the Rand, yeah. I think, on the Ridge. And more about, the reality of living in those times without refrigeration and all that kind of thing. I think, and another thing that astounded me was how he ran practices all over the world.
Yeah.
When you consider how long a letter would take.
Yes.
To get, and yet, these buildings were just going up.
It was extraordinary. And as an architect, that's one of the things that I recognize that perhaps an architectural historian might miss. They tend to look at the finished product, the buildings, but when you start to look at the process that Baker was going through, never mind the quality of output from all of that, just the fact he was running the most successful practice in Cape Town, which was putting up major buildings in the city centre, at the same time as he was building mansion after mansion after mansion here in Johannesburg, and then moving on to the public buildings and the union buildings. It's absolutely extraordinary how he did it. And as you say, I mean, communications were next to non-existent, really. And he was commuting back and forward from Johannesburg to Cape Town, quite regularly, just to maintain client contact, win new work, supervise the work, design the buildings. It was just an unimaginable task.
Unimaginable.
Yeah.
In his correspondence, did you find him describing Johannesburg, Johannesburg as it was then, the people? It was a mining camp.
It was. It's quite interesting because it's personal correspondence. So his views on arriving in Cape Town were quite juicy. For a young man from London, it was he really had arrived in a backwater.
Yeah.
And as you say, when he moved up to Johannesburg, in Milner, who invited him, knew it was effectively a mining town, but that it could be much more. And the hope was that he would start to build a civic architecture which would set the standard. But the reality was, almost as soon as he arrived, he got commission after commission from the landlords. But it must have been an utterly astonishing place with this incredible wealth, living in country houses such as you'd find in Surrey or Kent, up on the ridge, looking down on the tin roofs of much of the city, and it was a huge challenge to produce high quality architecture for those that could afford it in that kind of context.
Because in terms of the society in Johannesburg at that time, The stories are absolutely wonderful. You know, Lady Dalrymple from Glenshiel.
Mm.
Lady Dal was much loved, but she was a showgirl,
yeah.
I think, in England, and came out to become very grand.
Mm.
And the same with Josie Dale Lace, whose house you were in last night, and who's said to haunt Northwoods ever since. She was an actress,
yes.
And these women were a force
on the
Rand here.
Yeah, no, they were quite extraordinary. And I think Baker understood, you know, how the society worked. And a lot of those houses were for show. You know, they were for entertaining. They were for showing off. They were for socializing the next door neighbor. And, you know, they contain spaces that give they provide the opportunities for that kind of a life, both inside and outside, in the wonderful gardens, which sadly have been largely lost.
Yeah. So Baker was kind of finessing their ambition.
Absolutely. I mean, he was a very useful person to have to allow them to express their wealth as conspicuously as possible.
Tell me about which are your favourite buildings, Baker buildings? As you say, there's the three different kinds. There's the Cape Dutch, which was also, there was an honesty about those too.
Yeah.
Because he noticed them when he was looking for fruit farms with his brother when they were out riding. And instead of building, you know, new things, he took what the Dutch had bought and finessed that. So there was that. There was the arts and craft that he was able to replicate here because of the material, because of the rock, because of the wood that was available. So he was able to do that. And then finally, you know, those grand buildings and Delhi, etc. So
yeah.
I suppose sort of three kinds of
I mean, I'd probably put the Cape Dutch and the arts and crafts together, because he was imbued in the philosophy of the arts and crafts in London at the time. He went to meetings of the Art Workers Guild and so on. And that was a movement which was reacting to industrialising Britain. You know, they saw all of the industry and the mass housing and the growth of the cities as a bad, unhealthy thing. And so they looked back to a simpler, healthier, more rustic life. That became part of his approach, really. And so when he saw the Cape Dutch buildings, they just fitted into that exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then the arts and crafts style was well established by the time he came to Johannesburg, and he made his contribution to that. But the thing about Baker was he was learning and developing as an architect all the time. And so when he came to the classical work, I mean, I mentioned in the book, I mean, there's a few classical schoolboy errors in Pretoria Station, for example, his first classical building. But and yet, before that was even complete, he was onto the Union buildings and didn't put a foot wrong. I mean, they're just wonderful. And I mean, I have to say, as an architect, the classical work and his later work, I think, is his best. And I'd put the Union buildings and the Secretariats in Delhi, you know, right up there as his greatest achievement. Just outstanding.
Mm, they really are. Talking about things that are contested, I know you would be aware that, you know, there was a Fees Must Fall movement, an anti-Rhodes movement that spread as far as Oxford in the
UK.
Yeah. And Rhodes' memorial, which Baker had taken such care to build up on the slopes of Table Mountain, you know, it was vandalized, really. His nose was knocked off, you know, et cetera. And what do you think Baker would have thought about that? Would he have understood? What do you think?
I think he'd have been appalled.
Mm.
I think, I mean, he was, he worshipped Rhodes. He thought his vision was extraordinary. The breadth of thought that Rhodes had, you know, the ambition, you know, Baker completely bought into. So he actually wrote a biography of Rhodes as a tribute to the man. So that was their relationship. So for Baker, that he would have been appalled by what he would have seen as, you know, complete vandalism. But the reality is, removing statues has been going on for a very long time. You know, the first thing that the Irish did as soon as they achieved independence from the British was take down all the statues in Dublin.
Right.
Exactly the same happened in New Delhi. In fact, I actually visited an overgrown area just outside Delhi where all the statues were dumped. And you could walk through this near jungle and encounter a double life-size Queen Victoria next to Lord Curzon and so on. So it moves on. I mean, the great thing is his buildings have been adopted by, you know, modern South African society. You know, so great pride in the union buildings. You know, people look at that. Everyone looks at that and thinks that those are our government buildings. Mm. So the buildings have survived, and, you know, the loss of a few statues, yeah, I don't think it's a major problem in the bigger scheme of things.
And I also think of the gathering of people, you know, in his gardens at the Union building. You know, he had the vision for those, you know, that beautiful space.
Absolutely. And, I mean, it's so sad. I mean, I entirely understand why so much of the buildings have been cordoned off for security. I mean, it's the same around the world. I mean, his great vision was that people should actually come to the amphitheatre and that politicians should use that to talk to the people of the country.
In the classical Greek style.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as soon as he saw the site and he saw that there was a rock quarry there, the amphitheatre idea developed, and it was a symbol of democracy and open government. I think he'd be very sad that, you know, there is no public access to that area. But again, that's life. You know, we have threats that that they didn't encounter.
No, he didn't. Mm-hmm. John, it's been a pleasure talking to you. And I'm going to look at Herbert Baker's, you know, buildings as I go about my life here in Johannesburg with, you know, with new, fresh eyes. Well, thank you for the insight into him. So Herbert Baker, a biography written by John Stewart, and off to Cape Town now and more Baker houses.
I am indeed. I can't wait. Thanks very much for the discussion. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.